We're going to turn now to our first interview this morning. I've got Dr. Robin Youngson in the studio. Good morning, Robin.
Hi, Aaron. It's nice to be back here again. Thanks for the invite.
Welcome. So you've got a thing happening tomorrow night at the Old School Arts Centre at 7:30. I'm calling it a thing. There's a movie screening.
Yeah.
But you're not particularly responsible for the... You're in it, but you're not responsible for the movie happening, are you?
Yeah, it's the movie premiere of a short documentary film, which is called The Miracle in Raglan.
Right.
And it's what happened is you've interviewed me before about my book, The Science of Miracles, and my work in havening techniques. And one of the few people who read my book was the chief executive of an innovative mental health charity called Kiwis for Good.
Yeah.
And Tim Baker. And he got in touch and said, look, Robin, I'm so inspired by the work you're doing that we want to fund a documentary film about your work and about havening because we believe this could transform the mental health system. So, you know, can we do that?
Yeah.
So the filmmakers have made 5 or 6 visits to Raglan. We got a whole pile of my former clients, some of whom become students and now practitioners.
Yeah.
And it's an introduction to my backstory and, you know, my lifelong efforts to bring more humanity and compassion to healthcare and eventually to become disillusioned with the medical system, to tell about my stumbling across this therapy called havening techniques, which many people in Raglan are familiar with.
Yeah.
Because I provided free care to Raglan residents for one day a week for 6 years. And I've trained many people around the community. And it's some of those clients tell, I mean, just the most powerful stories of their suffering, of childhood sexual abuse, of being held up at gunpoint, of experiences of psychosis, you know, really major traumas in life. And then I talk about havening techniques and how it's based on a detailed scientific theory and how transformative it can be. And then these clients tell their stories of their life transformation. And then it goes on to say how many of them have become students and then practitioners and their experience of using havening techniques to help others. And it's all filmed in Raglan. There's lots of B-roll footage of the Raglan vibe and the streets and the shops and the people and the harbour scenes and drone footage. And, you know, it's just – and it's about how a small group of people based here in Raglan got together to begin to change the way we run a mental health system.
So – Can we, for those who don't know, can you tell us a little bit about havening, just how it works and what that science is?
So havening is a psychosensory therapy or process. It's basically based on a very detailed scientific theory of exactly how trauma is stored in a part of the brain called the amygdala, all the way down to the level of chemical and molecular reactions within the nerve cells. It's developed by Dr. Ron Rudin, a medical doctor in the USA, who's since retired. And in the course of that research, he discovered that under certain conditions, that chemical reaction could be set in reverse, and the world's worst trauma could be dissolved away sometimes in 15 or 20 minutes through the therapy. And what it depends upon is creating in the brain very slow brain waves, because the enzymes within the nerve cells are frequency sensitive. So during a traumatic event, we have very fast brain waves, which trigger chemical reactions to build new nerve connections that holds that trauma and sits in your brain for the rest of your life. It's permanent. And havening uses techniques that creates high levels of very slow brain waves called delta waves in the brain. And this catalyzes a series of enzymes and chemical reactions that breaks the nerve connections and removes the traces of the trauma from the brain. Now, the way that we create delta waves in the brain is through very specific forms of soothing touch to the palms of the hands and the upper arm and the face. And these are all natural and intuitive because people rub their hands together when they're nervous. When we see someone distressed and crying, we rub them on the upper arm. Mm. If we're overwhelmed, we rub our heads and our faces. And it was the intuitive genius of Dr. Rudin to put all these elements together and to create these therapies. And I came across this 7 years ago, and then 5 years ago quit my medical practice and have been a full-time havening practitioner and trainer ever since.
Did you start off by treating yourself?
Yeah, I did. When a very dear friend and colleague in the USA tried to tell me about havening, for several years, and I completely ignored him because I'd never heard anything so ridiculous. Because I asked him what it was. He said, you can have the worst trauma in the world, and you just stroke your arms and your hands and your faces for 15 minutes and occupy your mind with some neutral subject, and the trauma can be, you know, removed from your brain. Well, you know, I'm a scientist and a doctor. That was nothing more ridiculous I'd ever heard. So I ignored him. And then he wrote a whole book about it called 15 Minutes to Freedom. And I didn't even buy his book, even though he's a very dear friend. But my wife Meredith had a copy. And every time I went in a room, I saw it on the shelf. It was like a reproach to me. So eventually I said, hey, darling, can I borrow your book? Mm. That intrigued me. And I thought, actually, there could be some science behind this. So I Googled it and I found a video of someone healing a severe phobia. And I was just confounded by what I'd witnessed in 15 minutes. It just seemed impossible. And I sat there in a state of bewilderment and then began to ponder about some of my own terrible medical traumas, like seeing a young mother bleed to death in front of me despite my best efforts, you know, with a horrible traumatic image in my mind. Mm. And if I saw a story on a TV drama about, you know, an obstetric emergency, I would find myself sobbing. It would re-trigger that trauma. So I rewound the video and I copied the process, did the touch to myself, did the same mental distractions. And 15 minutes later, my trauma was inaccessible, was just gone.
Wow.
And so I Googled, how can I train in this? And a few weeks later, flew to Melbourne.
Was there still a bit of you that was a bit disbelieving that had happened? No,
because something very extraordinary had happened in my life.
Undeniable.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
it was, you know, this was not a minor change. This was life-changing. Yeah.
Yeah, I was watching a TV show based in a hospital last night, and all sorts of course, the TV shows are overly dramatic.
Yeah, yeah.
But still, it reminded me of the things you said, that medical people experience all sorts of trauma on the job.
Just dreadful.
Maybe on a weekly basis. Yeah. You know, I mean, just even being a surgeon, even though you're doing, you can have a successful thing, I still wonder about just the whole experience of cutting into a body and doing all that stuff.
When I'd been a doctor for a week in the UK, I was on duty for a weekend shift, and I came on duty at 8 o'clock on Saturday morning. And I came off duty at 5 o'clock on Monday afternoon, and I was continuously on duty all that time with only 3 hours of sleep. And during that time, I admitted 15 emergency patients that I did my best to treat, and 6 of them died. Mm. And, you know, that was my first weekend as a doctor. And I went home and I kept myself composed and did my best to treat everyone the best I could with my, you know, very limited knowledge and skills. And kept myself calm. And the moment I came off shift, I just started sobbing uncontrollably. I cycled 5 miles home just sobbing and sobbing and sobbing with the pent-up, you know, exhaustion and trauma. And you know, I mean, it was just dreadful.
Is that a common reaction, or do our doctors not tell us about
really? No one talks about it. It's not okay in the medical profession to ever admit any mental frailty or mental illness, or to talk about vulnerability or your feelings. I mean, I guess it's getting a bit better, but it hasn't changed a lot.
Yeah, maybe the wider changes in society are affecting, seeping
it's
into.
It's actually got worse
younger.
Now because our health service is under such duress that the levels of burnout are just getting, you know, epidemic.
Yeah, so you, I mean, you've kind of, have you almost completely removed yourself from the conventional medical system
I'm
now?
No longer, I don't have registration as a doctor anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you're kind of retirement age anyway, so you may not have by this
point.
Well,
I would like to retire, but I'm still paying a mortgage. And
right, okay. Okay, so you would have been working conventionally if that's all there was.
You know, we don't have any life savings. I've devoted my life to trying to make the system better and not earn lots of money, so.
So folks, we're talking to Dr. Robin Youngson about the film The Miracle in Raglan.
The Miracle in Raglan,
which is going to be, is it its premiere tomorrow night, Wednesday
it's
night?
It's the world premiere here in Raglan, because this is where the film was made, and it features lots of locals you'll recognize and the local scenes. And it's at 7:30 at the Old School. We're very grateful to the Old School for giving us a free venue. And and then Kiwis for Good, which is this mental health charity, are going to broadcast it out to the whole world. It'll be freely available.
I was going to ask how they do. I presume they have a YouTube channel.
They have extensive social media channels. They think they're going to push that out to about 100,000 people. So, and this is the first ever film about havening anywhere in the world.
Right. Um,
because Havening is an international, it's based in the USA, but there are trainers and practitioners in many countries.
Have we got to the point of having international Havening conferences yet where people come together?
Yeah, there is an international Havening conference, which is restricted to the practitioners and the students, and the next Havening conference actually is hosted in New Zealand in November.
Yeah. Not here in Raglan?
No, in Auckland.
So were you the first in New Zealand to do this?
No, I was number two. There was a lovely lady called Frances Lamb, who's a professional adult trainer in Wellington, and she was the first to train and become certified, and she became a trainer. I was number two.
Yeah.
And Frances has subsequently left the country. She wasn't so interested in doing the therapy, more in doing the training.
Yeah.
So I'm the Havener in the country with by far the most experience. I think I've looked after more than 1,000 clients.
And no doubt we have a disproportionate number of Havening practitioners in Raglan.
There's more Havening practitioners in Raglan per capita than any place in the whole world.
That sounds like Raglan. And I presume there are other practitioners popping up around the country?
I've trained and certified about 50 practitioners right around the country. I've got about 30 more in the pipeline. There are two other Havening trainers in New Zealand. So there's only about 1,100 certified Havening practitioners in the whole world, and so we have nearly 10% in New Zealand. So we have the fastest growing network. The frustration is that this is a revolutionary technique that can transform people's lives, as you hear from the stories in the film, and there's just so much resistance from the mainstream kind of medical system to, you know, what's seen as a woo-woo, non-evidence-based, you know, weird treatment. And I can't get funding from ACC for the work I do, even though I've transformed many ACC clients, but they've had to pay for it themselves.
How many decades did it take for acupuncture to become accepted by...
Sure.
Well, I guess that's what we're facing, isn't it?
It's a topic that's been researched. When there's a very major scientific advance in medical treatment and it's proven by multiple randomized control trials, well conducted, how long does it then take the medical system to incorporate in routine practice? Like something that would reduce the mortality of heart attacks by 50%, you know, a big thing. The answer to that question is 17 years.
Okay.
After it's scientifically proven.
That feels optimistic to me.
And that's why, I wrote a paper recently with my observations about how many of my clients with severe chronic pain simply lost their chronic pain. And the scientific theory of Havening completely explains why that could be the case. Mm. And it's miraculous to see. And I wrote a paper describing these case histories, the detailed scientific theory behind it, published it as a blog on my Substack. I mean, I approached a Facebook group of more than 6,000 pain practitioners, and they simply completely refused to share or publish my article. And I even appealed to the moderator of the group, who's a doctor, a pain specialist, and said, look, don't we owe it to our patients? And I'm an anesthesiologist, and I've treated pain for 30 years. And this is based on science, and it's a revolution. So, and there's just, you know, zit, zil. I mean, they just won't. It's just too threatening to the established, you know, expertise. So, I mean, and I'm fed up with trying to battle the system, and that's why I'm developing this practice called somatic compassion, which we can teach to anyone in the whole world.
So this is based on Havening, because this is the next thing I wanted to talk about. So
what I noticed after treating more than 1,000 Havening clients is that my clients were doing extraordinary and miraculous forms of spontaneous healing right in front of me. Not very much connected at all to the Havening techniques I was using. And I realized that the combination of compassionate presence and these soothing forms of touch really creates what I call a magical mind, an altered brain state in which trauma can spontaneously change. And this became so striking to me that I realized that actually we're not doing therapy. We're actually just creating the conditions for the human brain to do what it can do really well. So for instance, if someone has some, you know, horrible traumatic event that they don't want to talk about, and they create a metaphorical kind of monster to represent that, when we do Havening and we do the process for, you know, 5 or 6 minutes at a time. When we keep going back to the picture of that monster, the monster starts to shrink and get smaller and lose its arms and legs and turn into this kind of innocent blob. And I see these incredibly detailed visual changes occurring in the subconscious representation of a trauma. And when the horrible images disappear, then the trauma is just gone. And I've done that with chronic pain, where we've no idea what the origin of the pain is. And we just, the person imagines that this horrifying pain in the leg that they've had for 8 years is caused by this metal rod going down through their hip joint and knee joint and ankle joint, and it's kind of rough and jagged and it's kind of scraping the tissue.
It's a mental visualization.
So that's
of the,
a metaphorical representation of, you know, how the subconscious understands this thing. And with Havening, that image just dissolves away in highly specific ways. So I realized that maybe this is something we can teach to everyone. And there's no training course. There's no certification. We just take the professional out of it. So that's what we've been doing in workshops here in Raglan, and thanks to the Community House for giving us a free venue for that. Is just putting people in pairs, giving them 5 minutes of instruction, and say, okay, bring compassionate presence and soothing strokes to the arms and the hands, and talk about a life difficulty or a horrible life event, and then get the person to talk about their strengths, a time when they made a positive contribution in life. And then when they go back to the trauma, they find that it's dissolving away, or the life difficulty has been reframed, or the painful feelings are diminishing. And this is happening spontaneously in a process that just feels so natural and intuitive and is fun to do. And when we gather the people together and they share the stories of what they experience, there's so much positive energy in the room, and complete strangers are finding that they have this extraordinary, you know, intimate healing connection together. So that's what we're developing. And I've created a website, somaticcompassion.org, and Kiwis for Good are so excited about that development that they said, well, we're going to fund another documentary film, which is about that work.
Right.
So
okay.
The filmmaker's going to be coming back to Raglan again. And, you know, we're looking for volunteers to come to workshops and be part of that process of developing this and then spreading it around the world.
So you've had a couple of workshops already.
Yeah.
The last one was last Sunday, was it?
Yeah.
A couple of days ago.
Yeah. The first workshop, we had 20 people turn up, which astounded me. Because, of course, it was a Facebook event and 6 people said they're coming and 20 people came.
That sounds like Raglan.
Yeah, it does sound like Raglan.
Yeah, you can't predict who's going to come.
And people were just astounded by not only what they witnessed in themselves and others, but just how beautiful it felt, how relaxing, how energizing. I mean, at the end of the workshop, people didn't want to leave.
Mm-hmm. And you're talking about, like, these are emotional kind of blocks.
Yeah, emotional traumas.
But relating to physical, like you're talking about chronic pain, and there are other flow-on effects, health effects.
So what I learned from my work in Havening and the scientific theory behind it is that when we encode a trauma, when we store it in our brain, and there's a chemical reaction that occurs in maybe less than 10 minutes, we store every single bit of sensory information about that event. So everything that's happening outside of us, like, you know, if we're being attacked, the intruder, how we're being, you know, the context of setting the time into the quality of light, the sights and smells, and all of our internal experience. So our body state, our emotions, our thoughts, our stress reactions, all of that gets tied together in a traumatic memory. And every time it's re-triggered, which can occur in less than a tenth of a second, we recreate that whole experience. We relive it in the present. So if at the time of emotional trauma we had severe pain, then that becomes part of the trauma memory. And even if the tissues have long since healed, it can get repeatedly subconsciously triggered. So we end up with chronic pain, even though there's no tissue damage left anymore.
Mm.
And if we heal the trauma, the emotional trauma, then all of those nerve connections are pulled apart, including the nerve connections that connect to the chronic pain. So the pain just vanishes. It's a remarkable thing to see. And that applies to many other, weakness, disability, chronic pain, restrictions of breathing, gut problems, you know, IBS, inflammatory bowel disease, bladder problems. I mean, so many of these have an emotional component behind them. I mean, we're mind-body creatures.
Are there any chronic health problems that don't have an emotional component?
Probably not, because if you have a chronic health condition, you also get emotionally traumatized because you feel trapped in paralysis, right?
Yeah, so yeah.
So there's
either
always
way.
An overlay.
Yeah.
So even if it's not the cause, there's this big overlay. And when people come free, one of my clients is a young man in his mid 20s with autism and ADHD and severe social phobia, and he was almost afraid to leave his home because if he walked into town, he might meet someone and have to engage with them. And so many people assume that social phobia is just part of autism. But I thought about, you know, the experience of growing up autistic and how much bullying and exclusion you would experience and, you know, how traumatizing that would be. So we said, well, why don't we try and treat the trauma and see what happens? And he really transformed his life. He completely lost his social phobia. He ended up chatting up strangers on the bus. He started going out every day, going for walks every day. He went to the gym every day. He lost 20 kilograms. He totally improved his diet. He's now got a driver's license. He's got a job. He's doing volunteer work. And I record an interview from him, which I put on YouTube, of this man with autism and social phobia who was almost too scared to meet anyone, now talking to the world on camera.
I imagine everyone who's got autism will develop social phobia because of the reaction they'll get from people.
Of course.
Yeah. Their whole life, every person they meet is going to be like, you're a bit odd.
Anywhere on the neurodiverse spectrum. And you know, one of the people you see in the film is a young man with schizophrenia and psychosis and voices in his head. And it's completely transformed his life. And I had another client, you know, who just stopped paying any attention to the voices at all and, you know, developed compassion for the people that have the voices and just ignored them. And they couldn't torment him anymore. So even established really severe mental health diagnoses like schizophrenia have this big overlay of trauma. And trauma certainly has a major part in their genesis. So if we treat the trauma, we might actually be able to make very significant inroads into major mental health problems.
Well, because you talked several times about the overlays that happen, like you've got the one thing and then that and that just causes people to react to you differently and probably you're very self-condemning as well.
Yeah.
And all those overlays, so if you can remove those, it would make a difference.
What it needs is a complete reversal of the mental health paradigm, because traditionally the world of psychiatry and mental health because we have a medical science that treats the body like a machine and not like a conscious being, the assumption has been that mental illness is a brain disease. There's something wrong in the brain. There's an imbalance of chemicals or, you know, something wrong.
But we know that scientifically that's not the case now, don't we?
Well, we've endlessly tried to find it and we haven't been able to find it.
Yeah.
You know, so there's no biomarker for schizophrenia or for depression or any other condition. But because of that, the mental health system has evolved whereby the person is deemed to have a pathology, gets a diagnostic label and is pathologized, and the psychiatrist or the doctor giving an antidepressant or the counselor or the psychotherapist kind of do therapy to the client to an extent, and the client feels kind of helpless. But what we're saying is that actually maybe mental health is caused by all the stresses and traumas outside of ourselves, that the source of mental illness is actually out there in the community. And the cure of it is within ourselves. So all the work I'm doing is actually just activating the innate capacity for people to heal themselves. So it's a reversal of the power dynamic, and it's a reversal of the assumptions about mental health. And so what we want to do now is take, you know, approaches that support mental health and well-being, you know, out of the economic system, so that, you know, there's no therapist, there's no fee, there's no professional registrations. It's just ordinary people connecting together in a way that human beings are supposed to connect together, with compassion, compassionate presence and touch, you know, healing each other in really remarkable ways. And what I'm observing is truly remarkable.
So,
and it's, you know, the world has become individualistic and, you know, there's so much emphasis on self-help and self-care, but actually we need to come together again as human beings.
So when is the next workshop for the somatic?
So we haven't planned it yet, so we need to schedule that because the filmmakers need to be booked in advance, but in a month or two. But we'll let everyone know.
Okay, all right, and we'll let people know on our, like we do with everything. The... you were talking there about the source of mental illness might be in the outside world.
Yes.
Well, I don't know if we've got time for this, but sometimes that sort of thinking is described as getting political or it's not quite the right word. There's all sorts of ways of stopping health professionals looking. I feel like there is,
clearly there are massive, there. Huge societal determinants of mental, mental illness and stress.
It makes sense to most of us, but that's not how it's.
Yeah. So, for instance, I mean, back in, there was a book called The Spirit Level, which is two researchers, PhD researchers in the UK, who looked at income inequality in societies and how it correlated to various forms of physical and mental illness. And if you have high levels of income inequality, such as we do in New Zealand, where the rich get richer and richer, and people, on a minimum wage, I mean, almost 90% of the population gets poorer and poorer.
Yeah.
That level of income inequality is related to, a 3 or 4 times increase in the level of obesity or mental illness or whatever. So if we have societal conditions that create poverty and stress and poor housing and bad food and all these things obviously impact greatly on mental health. And there's many correlations.
Mm.
But what I'm talking about is emotional trauma, about how our life experiences under certain circumstances can get imprinted in our brain. And that can start even inside the womb, before we're even born.
Yeah.
The brain circuits and chemical systems that can do that are present and active in the baby before the baby's even born.
I feel like anything that, it's fairly clear that anything that challenges the established order is going to be resisted, and that people who benefit from being part of this, the more you benefit from being part of the established order, the more inclined you probably will be to reject that. But you're someone who's obviously was one of those people who benefited from being part of the established order, but you've gone somewhere else. You wrote a book with the word miracle in the title. You called yourself a healer in the book. So are you no longer invited to the doctor's parties?
In the film, I'm described as a maverick doctor.
Yeah, right. There we go.
But, I'm still well known for my international work on compassionate healthcare. In September this year, I'm invited as a keynote speaker at the Royal College of Surgeons to talk about the importance of compassionate care. So I'm in this kind of gray zone of
because you are established.
Yeah, I mean,
and they obviously can't deny that.
I sat on national committees. I've been an advisor to the WHO. I won the highest prize of the New Zealand Medical Association, But those things count for nothing if you're trying to promote something that's kind of threatening to the establishment. So that's why I've given up trying to battle against the system.
Yeah.
And I've said, well, this is actually something that every human being can do in a really remarkable way, but we've just forgotten about human connection and touch in our individualistic world.
Yeah.
And, we have the rise of AI and AI therapists and counselors, which seem to do a job almost as good as a human counselor, and that's really scary. But then I have so many clients that said, I've had years of therapy and counseling, and it helped for sure, but it just never took this away from inside me. And you'll hear that from in the film, people telling, in floods of tears about the impact of their trauma and how they've pursued a lifetime of therapies without ever getting it better, and then having a session of evening and finding it dissolve away. Reconnecting as human beings and touching each other is something we really have to do as AI starts to take over the whole world.
Yeah, well, that's one thing it can't do is human touch.
No.
Well, it's probably several things it can't do, but let's not get into the AI discussion right now. It is time to wrap it up. If you want to see this film, it's going to be on Wednesday night, 7:30 at the Old School. Is there a cost, Robin?
It's a $10 ticket price. All the proceeds are going to Kiwis for Good. And you must buy a ticket. There's limited seats. Yeah.
Are there still tickets available?
There are tickets available, yes.
Okay, all right.
Yep.
And if it sells out, will we see it? Will it show again, perhaps?
It'll be widely available online, so
anyway,
we'll be sharing it right around the whole world.
Will there be the film? Will people get to ask questions at the end?
So after the film, we'll probably make people cry, and the filmmaker will be there, and I'll be there. The Tim Baker sadly can't be there from Kiwis for Good, but he's spoken to camera and an introduction to the film and the motivations for making it. And some of the people who are in the film might be there in the audience. And yeah, we'll have a wide-ranging discussion.
Okay.
About it. And yep.
All right, Robin, thanks for coming in.